So it's September 15th, 2006. I'm David Brooks, and I'm doing the oral history interviews for the University of Montana's Oral History Project. Today I'm speaking with Dr. Meyer Chesson. And Dr. Chesson, I'd like, if you could, to start out with just a little of your personal background, your educational background, what brought you to Missoula and the University of Montana.
Well, I think it might take a few hours to do justice to it, but I'll try to be succinct. I was born in New York in 1921 of immigrant parents. They both came from the Russian Empire, one dad from White Russia and my mother from the Ukraine. And they came over in 1910, or very close to that. They met here, actually. And, of course, this is one of the huge immigrations from that part of the world, especially Russian-Jewish immigrations, because of what was happening. And, in fact, my dad, in a sense, was escaping the Tsar, who was looking for all the people that were involved in the 1905 revolution, mm-hmm. and he was one. And so that was one reason that they came, but of course many other conditions that were driving them here. They settled in New York, although my dad had spent some years in Allentown, Pennsylvania at an uncle of his, and I believe he worked in the steel mills in Bethlehem for a while before he actually came to New York. My mother came to a family in Rhode Island, and then they met in New York. And he became a furrier in the garment industry before he bought a little grocery store in the Bronx. And that's where I grew up, mm-hmm. basically. So that was, I suspect, one of the more formative parts mm-hmm. of my existence. I went to public schools there, and I think I received quite a good education. Formal education, of course, the diversity of peoples from all over Europe, mostly where we were living, was, and we were living in a fairly dense neighborhood. So I got to know people of all kinds, and I treasure that part of my background a great deal. We were also, at that time, the Bronx had a lot of parks, and one of them was a rather large one, just a block away from where we were living, and I ran off to the park whenever I could. And when people ask me, how did you end up in botany? Teaching botany, I said, well, I really got out to the park very often, and I always had a yen for the out-of-doors. In any event, I attended a grade school close to home, and then I went to a junior high school, which was in a special program, a rapid advance program, they call it, where you made 3 years in two. So in those 3 years, in those 2 years, that included a year of high school. And then I started high school as a sophomore. Still in knickers, I think. But, and that was a very, also quite an experience, because it was in a somewhat poorer neighborhood than ours. And mainly it was Italian immigrants, whereas ours was more diverse, a large percentage of Jews, but also people from all over Europe. And I'm not sure whether they put us kids in a venue like that, in that kind of a neighborhood. I often wondered about that. The principal was a very famous educator by the name of Angelo Patri. And I remember he had a column, a weekly column in the New York Times. I guess it was in the Sunday Times, I'm not sure, in which he discussed educational issues. And he was the principal of that junior high school. And he was just, you know, I thought we all looked up to him, all the kids there. And here were these rapid advancers who were tended to be somewhat younger than the average, because they would skip grades. And then we were placed in amongst the kids in the neighborhood who tended to be somewhat behind on the average because of family backgrounds. They didn't have that much of a bookish type of existence. And so there we were, you know. And I thought, sometimes I thought, well, that was a deliberate thing on their part to try to get us and maybe them. You know, we could see what the other part of the city looked like, and then they could see these little kids and so far ahead because they studied and so on and so forth. I'm not sure that was the case, but it was just a memorable part of my experience. Sometimes a little scary, because here were these big 17-year-old kids, and there were these little Knickerbocker-wearing boys, and on the playground, sometimes a bit of a problem there, but no, we had a wonderful education there. After finishing high school, well, we went through the Depression. Since I was born in 1921, when I was about 8 years old, it really hit, and then continued all through my high school years, certainly. And it particularly impacted our little grocery store, because, again, it was a neighborhood store, and there were a lot of people that were affected by the economic effects of the Depression, lost their jobs, and sometimes they had to be provided with food. We personally never suffered that way because we had a grocery store, but a lot of my friends did, and that was that whole experience was another formative part of my upbringing and my outlook on life, because I saw some of my friends out on the street in the middle of winter with all their furniture because I couldn't afford to pay the rent, and that influenced me greatly and permanently and until this day. Well, after high school, I was slated to go to a college in New York, but my dad had a friend who came to see him, just unannounced, from Detroit. He was one of his buddies in the old days, in the Revolution, and he had a chicken farm in Southern California. He had lived in Detroit, but then he was living in California. He had a chicken farm in the San Fernando Valley, which at that time was very rural. And he asked my dad to come along with him, because my dad had to give up the store, and he had developed a rather serious disease. And wasn't life-threatening, but he was very slow in recovering. And so he had really nothing to lose. But after a week or so, he wrote and told us that if we wanted to see him, we'd have to come to California. And so we did. And since I was slated to start college, I just transferred to UCLA.
Mm-hmm.
So I lived with him for 6 months before the rest of the family came over, which consisted of his mother, who was... he'd come over, maybe she was in her 30s when she had come over, and she never really reconciled to this country. She knew some English, of course, she had to, but she didn't converse. So until us kids went to public school, I had two sisters. And since my mother had to be at the grocery store most of the time, she raised us, basically. So I spoke only Yiddish until I went to school. Well, of course, I spoke it in the streets, but our language mainly was Yiddish with my grandmother and with my folks as well. So that, too, became an important part of my being and psyche, and I find that it's not that hard to remember the language. But after 2 years at UCLA, it was kind of a pre-agriculture course at UCLA. I transferred to Berkeley. And finished up with a BS in plant pathology in the College of Agriculture. And that was still, see, that was 41 before we entered the war. And the economy was still not that great. So, and we were living right at the beach in Venice, California. And so it was very easy for me to become a beach bum. I just loved it. And now I'm trying to see if I can create the exact chronology of what happened after that. I think what happened next was that on the beach I met some girl that I had known at school, I think at Berkeley, and she had some friends who had come, and she was at the beach for the summer, and then one day she had some friends visiting her at the beach. And it was a very interesting family. The father of that family was Philip Lovell, who was another one of these weekly columnists for the L.A. Times. And I think he had a background in chiropractic, but he was way ahead of his time in terms of health foods and healthy living styles. Of course, California is where it started. I don't know if you're from California, do you know?
No.
But he was there with his family, and one of his sons, the younger son, was there too. And he asked me if I was doing anything. I was doing, working, and he asked me if I would be interested in coming along with him to sell watermelons. His dad had a farm in Hemet, California, which is out close to the desert, and with water, they could really grow a lot of crops, and they had a huge watermelon crop, and so I said, sure, we'll go along with you and try to peddle watermelons. We went to all the markets around Southern California. And I don't think we did too well, but we did sell some. But that led to an opportunity. The doctor asked me if I would be interested in coming to and work on his ranch. It was really a farm, you know. They had some cattle. They had some dairy cattle. It was basically the cash crop was avocados, but they had everything else there. And it was a place called Fallbrook, California, which was about 25, 30 miles inland from Oceanside, which is on the coast, but somewhat north of San Diego, between L.A. and San Diego. And it was in the Santa Margarita Mountains, where Mount Palomar, which was a well-known observatory, the most absolutely beautiful place. Now, what a dream, you know, environment. The Santa Margaritas were just a beautiful coastal range. And I remember I used to, for exercise, I would hike on Sundays on my day off, more or less my day off, because, you know, the cows and the chickens and pigs and everything else had to be fed, but it was just beautiful. The Santa Margarita Mountains, of course, was taken over by the U.S. Marine Corps, and that's where Camp Pendleton was. I think Camp Pendleton is more down on the coast near Oceanside, but that's where all the activities, the military activities are done at Camp Pendleton, and then that whole area is just burgeoned, you know, with all kinds of development. But I had my day in the sun there. Is again just a beautiful part of old California, mm-hmm. you know, before it really was discovered, because the war, December 7th, I was still working on the ranch at 41. Of course, I knew immediately that the life would be changed, and and then I got a little restless. I'd worked there about a year, almost a year, and I had a chance. I actually got a job offer from the California Department of Agriculture to be a junior plant quarantine inspector on one of their border stations. This one was in Northern California, out of Reno, a little spot called Peavine on Highway 395, out way out in the sagebrush. And again, it was, you know, an eye-opener for me to see that kind of country and isolation and space. So that's what I did for some months. We were expected to inspect every car that came into the state and to have certain contraband goods. They had to be either eaten on the spot, which they couldn't always do, or we would have to take it and burn it. And I remember very vividly, again, an important episode when, and we had a lot of so-called Okies and Arkies coming through from the Middle West and from the mm-hmm. South, because, you know, the Dust Bowl Depression, and, you know, they were just John Steinbeck. mm-hmm. describes it in Grapes of Wrath, I guess. And that's what they looked like. I mean, these ramshackle trucks would come by with whole families piled high on these trucks. And I remember one family had some, I think they were sweet potatoes. And we had to take those sweet potatoes, and I remember burning them. We weren't supposed to eat them ourselves, mm-hmm. you know, burn them. Because, they could be carrying some kind of disease. That was. And then movie stars would come up from L.A., dashing along Highway 395, and many of them were in open roadsters. And I remember Walter Brennan, but there were others, too. So that was kind of interesting. That. But Then I thought, well, I should be doing something a little more directly connected to the war effort. So I got a job in the Richmond shipyards. And there, too, I worked as a junior machine welder for the Liberty ships. That's what they're putting together, those tankers, freighters, that they could put together very quickly. I guess they mostly carried cargo, but I guess they could carry people as well. And I was involved in welding some of the steel plates. And again, an experience, since I had, led a rather isolated life in many ways. Then there were guys from all over the country, different backgrounds, and I developed a real admiration for Yankee ingenuity. these are guys from every walk of life, and they just seemed to pick up the kind of work that they had to do with craft as if it was natural for them. And you got to know them as real people too. So that was great. I guess I was visiting home when I got I was visiting home and I decided to, my friends had been going off to the war. I hadn't been drafted, so I thought I'd enlist in the Marines because, for one reason, they had a deal where if you were a college graduate, you could go directly to OCS, mm-hmm. to Officer Candidate School. And I said, well, that might be a good deal, because I recognized that maybe that would make me part of the shock troops, but, after all. So I applied for that, and when while I was waiting to hear from them, I got a letter from the FBI claiming that I had received draft notices, which I hadn't, and if I didn't respond to this one, they would come and get me. So, my application had not been finally processed for the Marines, so I was drafted into the Army. And so I went directly from there, from California, to a reception center in San Pedro, and then waited for an assignment. And I waited and waited. I think I was there for at least a week or two, whereas the other guys would be coming in 2-3 days. At the most, they would be getting their assignment. And so I thought, well, this is something special, they've got cooked up for me, because they're just waiting to find just the right niche. And so finally one day I saw my name on a list, and it was a long list. And that's the reason it had taken so long, because the long list of people that they were sending to an infantry replacement training center in Camp Roberts, California. And that's what I did for my basic training. I was in the infantry. And then, again, you see, the reason I'm here, David, is things like that happened. 1 week before we were slated to go over to the South Pacific, which was quite a war zone at the time, Solomon Islands, Guadalcanal, and so on. There were a bunch of people that came around to interview us to go back to college in different fields that sort of, related: physical science, mm-hmm. physics, chemistry, engineering, and I was sent back to school. So, the contrast between our training and then being in downtown Pasadena while we were being processed there to go to whatever college was quite startling. I ended up at Ohio State, and finally in electrical engineering there.
And was that by your choosing, or did they
put you in a program? That's what I say. Right. This could take hours, David, you know. They selected me for advanced chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because I'd had quite a bit of chemistry in my agricultural background. And that was the closest thing to what they wanted. So I was presumably going into chemistry. And the first summer, we arrived early in the summer. The first summer was a quick refresher course in physics, chemistry, and math. We had all three subjects. Just a quick review of college, physics, math, and chemistry, you know. And so that was fine, you know, it was kind of intense, but it was, who could complain? However, when that was over, when I arrived at Ohio State, they said I would have to choose some form of engineering. So I said, okay, well, chemical engineering, probably the closest thing to it. And so we went through, and then by the time that summer was over, chemical engineering had been removed from the curriculum, and I had to choose between civil and electrical. So I took electrical. I thought there'd be more math involved, and little did I know that civil was probably closer to what I would enjoy, being out of doors. But anyway, so I ended up in electrical engineering, communication engineering, you know, a lot of pretty advanced math in it. But typically when it was over, it was a year and a half of that, and we didn't get a degree of any kind, whereas when the Navy sent people to a school like that, the V-12 program, they would get a degree, a bachelor's in the subject, but, you know, typical of the Army, that wasn't true, and you never knew where you would end up. I was lucky that I ended up at in the Signal Corps, at least. So I sent me to radio school, and I learned all about radios, and, you know, and again, from there, they sent us to a training center for a civilian agency. So we had essentially civilian conditions there. We were still expected to wear our uniforms while we were there. I neglected to point out that I met my wife-to-be, my future wife, at Ohio State at a dance, a USO dance. And we've been together since. So
what year was that?
That was 43.
Okay.
That I met her. We got married when I was in camp in 45. So it's 61 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we were being trained in that Hog Island, Philadelphia, to install radio stations, fixed radio stations, and I was a radio repairman in the team. We had linemen and Trent. I was a radio repairman. Others were a radio installer and so on and so forth. But and then in the meanwhile, the war in Europe and the war in Japan were over. The war was over. And so I missed combat entirely. And then they sent us, after our training, they sent us to Berlin in occupation duty to put up a radio station.
Mm-hmm.
And I often wonder, what were they doing with that fixed station there in Berlin? What were they doing it for? I think it had something to do eventually with the airlift, the Berlin airlift that happened later after the Soviets closed all highways into Berlin. So we did that, and I spent the winter in Berlin, so that was not quite combat, but the shooting was still going on at night. I don't know for what purpose. It was a completely destroyed city. Just utter destruction. People were living in basements, mostly. So that was also a part of my education, which stayed with me. You know, the utter destruction that war has attained in the 20th century. So that led me to an interest in the peace movement. I always had, always felt that it would be great to teach at a college or university. And so I went back and got my doctorate in plant physiology. I was advised by the head of the Department of Plant Pathology, which was associated with the College of Agriculture, this is where I got my degree, that as a person with an urban background, okay, urban, perhaps I wouldn't feel too comfortable in plant pathology because you have to go out and meet farmers. And, you know, you may not have the background to fit comfortably into that niche. Mm-hmm. I myself didn't feel that way, but I got the message. So I switched, you know, the reason I'm here, you see, I switched to plant physiology because I was going to work on plant viruses anyway, and I do a physiological problem with plant viruses. So it was sort of a bridging type of thesis that would cover disease and physiology of plants at the same time. And so I got my doctorate there.
Where were you?
At Berkeley.
Okay.
I went back to Berkeley. I considered going elsewhere. Just, you know, mm-hmm. thought it might be interesting, and I had a chance to go to Illinois and work with a pretty big guy in the area of photosynthesis, and which always interested me, you know, up until then and then after. But it just seemed, since I had my undergraduate work at Berkeley, it seemed that I wouldn't have to take too many courses. And it's funny what things determine your choices at certain times. That was one. It would be a lot quicker, and I was kind of anxious to finish up after from 41 to 46, 5 years out of school, and I was married, and I was anxious to be out mm-hmm. in the world. So I thought the quicker the better, mm-hmm. and that's one reason I went back to Berkeley. But I never regretted it
mm-hmm.
because Berkeley was still, you know, a graduate. For example, the graduate degree of plant physiology, which is where I took my degree, had 70 plus faculty people that could advise you in your thesis. They had faculty from all over the campus, you know, in the science departments, chemistry, physics, microbiology, even one zoologist, and they had, you know, such a big choice, and that was typical of, you know, the Berkeley campus. You could get a liberal education by reading the bulletin boards, I felt. Not when I first came here, but now you can. Mm-hmm. But anyway.
So when did you finish at Berkeley?
I finished Berkeley in 49.
Okay.
Okay. And my choice of plant physiology was fortuitous because the jobs in academia were still not that, you know, available.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that I had my degree in plant physiology interested the chair of the botany department here, who was looking for a replacement for somebody who was teaching the course in plant physiology, who was going back to get his doctorate. He was apparently an excellent teacher and all, but he had to go for that.
Mm-hmm. Who was the chair at the time?
Chair at the time was J.W. Severy. And there, you know, First of all, I had a degree in plant physiology. So plant physiology was the subject that he wanted taught. If I'd had it in plant pathology, I'm not so sure that I'd gotten the job, even though I have the same background. Yeah. So that was one thing. Another thing is he got his degree in plant physiology at the University of Wisconsin, working on the physiological effects of virus infection, which is what I was working on for my thesis. I mean, he's fortuitous things. Another thing is he was considering another applicant from Columbia University for the same job. And he said, well, you know, Mike, that's what they called me, he's from Berkeley. And so, you know, he probably has a little more understanding. We were teaching foresters, mainly. That was our service. That was our service in botany. That's what was the raison d'etre of the botany department. And the foresters at that time were all expected to take almost 2 years of botany from botanists. Interesting enough now, the forestry school gradually encroached on those courses until botany went from a high of 11 faculty down to almost three in just a few years. But anyway, so there, this other fellow was Columbia, he might not, you know, interact so well. Of course, I was from New York originally, too. And, so, you know, all these fortuitous things happened, and he was able to hire me on the spot. He came down to Berkeley when I was still working there from a meeting in Vancouver, and he offered me the job. Just like that. So, and when I responded to the letter, you know, he wrote a letter to me describing the position and the place. And, you know, it's a boyhood dream to come to a place for any kind of biology here, fishing, skiing, small town, liberal arts school. You know, what more could you ask? Could I ask? You know, because liberal arts was an important part of the appeal to me. And Bozeman may not have been quite so attractive. But anyway, that was the job, one job offer, and I came here and stayed.
Well, what made the liberal arts nature of this school attractive to
I was you? Politically oriented. I mean, that was part of my life. I mean, I was a scientist, and I threw myself into that completely. But as a student at Berkeley, you know, Berkeley, even way back then, when I was an undergrad, I finished, got my degree in 41, and then I came back from 46 to 49, it really exploded. They went through all kinds of, well, we were going through all kinds of political upheavals. I remember Henry Wallace was running as a progressive anti-war candidate against Truman and Dewey. And we had a huge crowd outside Sather Gate, which is the southern end of the Berkeley campus. A huge crowd came to hear Henry Wallace, and we worked in his campaign. And so we've been active. I've always been active, and I got involved with some of the fellow grad students at Berkeley there, and they were pretty savvy politically as well. We were all some kind of socialist, and we had, you know, that creates all kinds of arguments, and which is the proper road. Because I had been caught up in that, I won't say net. I'm not, you know, I don't regret it, but it was just in the air. It was in the air, and it didn't take long for me after I got here to see there are people like that here too, and it was a much smaller school at the time. And, for example, the English department would have a weekly seminar And many of them had philosophical, social, you know, political implications, or even different approaches to how literature can apply to our lives. For one thing, there was one fellow from England who was here for a short while, but he was what I call a Lewisite. It was C.S. Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
Not Lewis. Lewis is the one that wrote the got involved in. Was it Leavis? I think it was Leavis from Oxford. It was Leavis versus that fellow at Cambridge. Oh, who was the guy in Cambridge? Oh God, I'd have to do some research on that. There was a big discussion as to what extent the humanities should be more esoteric, ascetic, and detached, or should it be more involved in what was happening in the world?
God, now, how did you make that crossover into being with that group of people, being in the sciences? I mean, you're over here in the botany department.
Well, yeah, in terms of people, of course, there had to be some people in my department.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose the key link there was a fellow by the name of Joseph Kramer. Smokey Joe Kramer. And he was, first of all, he came from the same background as my parents, from Lithuania. And he came here when he was in his 20s to this country, and then he worked on farms in Alabama, New Mexico, and he ended up at a camp for Jewish boys who wanted to go into agriculture. Baron de Hirsch was a famous philanthropist who had camps in New Jersey and elsewhere. I'm not sure which one he went. I think he went to New Jersey. So he was another one that wanted to be a farmer,
mm-hmm.
to get out of the shtetl,
mm-hmm.
out of the strictly urban existence. And that's what drove him as well. But he was also a scholar. He had been trained eventually to be a rabbi, went to a yeshiva for a while. So all those strains were present in him, and you know, I think I mirrored to some extent,
mm-hmm.
that background.
Mm-hmm.
And he described himself as an Orthodox atheist Marxist. So you talk about different elements going into the psyche, and you know, I'm afraid that you know, some of us first generation types were, mm-hmm. caught up in that.
You know, it's when I think of first generation immigrant or the children of immigrants, intellectual movements, political, social,
mm-hmm.
movements.
Yeah.
You do think of places like Berkeley or New York City, urban or large universities.
Right.
And so it's a little surprising to hear about that here in what would have been fairly rural Missoula,
right.
Montana, at this small university,
right.
at the time.
But there was it was 100 faculty. I knew every one of them by name,
mm-hmm.
and sight.
Mm-hmm.
And I hardly know the people in the biological sciences now. Of course,
mm-hmm.
I've been retired, but it was much smaller. And it was still, you know, a product of what had gone on through the Depression. And Montana had a kind of special history, a pioneer history, in which there were not too many buffers involved between people. You know, the Wobblies were strong here.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these people were identified with them. I mean, they were college professors, But, you know, they spoke lovingly of the Wobblies. And, well, one of them was Mel Wren. Mel Wren was chair of history for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. And then Joe Kramer, Smokey Joe, they call him, because he was, you know, kind of tempestuous. And he was, and I assisted him in his class in ecology. I had never had a course in ecology as such, because at Berkeley, which considered itself the Harvard of the West, ecology was considered a synthetic science. You had to be a taxonomist or a physiologist or a geneticist, but ecology is a mishmash mm-hmm. of everything. So Berkeley did not get involved. I'm not sure they have a course in ecology yet. Now they call it natural resources, you see, so they could get over that.
Right.
I assisted him in his class, so I sat in on all his lectures, and I had some labs, and we'd go out on field trips a lot in the ecology class, so I learned the jargon, and, you know, it didn't take me long to really become fond of environmental aspects. So he was one of the people that would take me over to the English department. The English department had people like Leslie Fiedler was here. He was another one, you know. He was a Trotskyite, and we were more, I wouldn't say Stalinist, but we were not Trotskyites either. We were fellow travelers. Mm-hmm. That's what they called us. Stalin was a little too hard to stomach. So they would attend these ecumenical things on campus. The campus was much more integrated and collegial at that time. And we even had weekly assemblies. We used to have weekly assemblies for, well, maybe not more than 10 years after I came, but perhaps a little more. Every Friday, we'd have the assembly at 9:30 to 10:30, and the other Friday morning classes were shortened. And the whole campus would go to the, what used to be the theater. Well, went to the theater, to the university theater. It's still there. Mm-hmm. To have some sort of university, we'd sing some songs, and we'd have a speaker. Pretty often we'd have somebody from the outside to come over and tell us what was going on in the world. And of course, it happened to be the Christmas program. And I thought it was a great addition, but I couldn't get George Denison to revive it when he came on board.
So, you know, you've mentioned that there were around 100 faculty at the time, and you knew them all, and it sounds pretty collegial.
But we weren't all on the same wavelength. That's another thing.
Mm-hmm.
No buffers,
mm-hmm.
you know, because we had some people who didn't like people like Joe from the old country. He had an accent, a very heavy accent.
Mm-hmm.
He was a leftist, and they were pretty upset with him. Not, you know, by no means a majority of the faculty, but there were, you know, people even in his own division and maybe department that were kind of that way,
mm-hmm.
but they mellowed. So there was some of that undercurrent.
Mm-hmm.
But not, I never felt that it really affected me personally. And I thought they had good enough people in administration so that they would keep their eye on the ball as to what the person was doing, you know, in class, mm-hmm. in the lab, and so on. And in service. Service was a big part of the triangle. We're expected to do public service.
Mm-hmm. So what were some of the public service things that you were involved in? And also,
okay,
talk a little bit about, you know, where students and the administration fit in that
right.
scene at the time.
I guess I was blessed with administrators who were reasonably open
mm-hmm.
and liberal-minded. The first one was James McCain, who was only here for 1 year. He was great. He and Joe would exchange pleasantries as they went to get their mail in Main Hall. Main Hall used to have a bunch of pigeonholes for the faculty for their mail, for their faculty mail. So you'd have to go up to Main Hall and you'd meet people there. And Jim McCain, apparently was quite a reader. And Joe Kramer, of course, he read everything in sight, you know, not only in his field, but in every other field as well. And so they would meet on the steps and they talk about the latest book that they were reading. And that was kind of the environment that we had on a continuing basis. Not all of them were that kind of a scholar as an administrator, but I think, you know, George Denison is the person I could talk to on that score. And we had a vice president, Richard Landini, who actually taught a class in English while he was here. And he was another one that would stop and talk to you about what you were reading. So some of the administrators tend to be rather arbitrary in terms of strict administrative prerogatives. And it was before we had a faculty senate. So that was one of the big struggles that we went through, to get a faculty senate that would have a reasonable faculty voice in university affairs.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that, you know, took quite a time and energy over the years. We had different presidents that crossed the faculty, and of course there were always the question of who was with the administration and who was not. And but then we had an AEUP before the Senate, and the AFT, American Federation of Teachers, was small, but it had a lot of the people that I described as being really very progressive politically. Mike Mansfield was a charter member of the union. He was the secretary treasurer of the teachers union.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure whether Edmund Freeman was in that group, although he was in the union. And H.G. Merriam. And I was a member. I joined the union early on, and we had maybe half a dozen people would regularly come to meetings long before it became the bargaining agent.
Mm-hmm.
for the faculty. So there's always been that kind of a tradition in the faculty of really competent professors with a social outlook.
So what was the purpose of the teachers' union before they became the bargaining agent?
Well, they would, I suppose, get together.
What were you doing?
Yeah, we'd get together. We would try to bargain, mm-hmm, with them informally,
mm-hmm,
you know, express our point of view. The AFT and the AUP, although there was little too much of a rivalry between them, I think there were times when they got together. In fact, we, at least 1 year, I think it was Al Stone, a law professor that I had gone to school with in Berkeley. Al Stone was president of both organizations, and that didn't last. That arrangement didn't last. And, you know, eventually, when the salaries started to pinch, mm-hmm, then the union grew. And the union grew became a bargaining agent by vote.
Now, is that the Al Stone that was in the journalism department?
No, that's that? Dean Stone.
Okay.
Now, what was his first name? Dean. It's interesting. Dean. It wasn't Albert Stone.
Yeah, I want to say his initials. I've just seen him by his initials, A.L.
Oh, is that right? Wow. Maybe his name was Albert, too.
I could be remembering that wrong.
No, I think
I'll
you're
have
right
to check it, no, but I think it's A.L. Stone,
yeah,
maybe?
I think you're right.
A.J. Stone.
I think you're right. But no, Al Stone was
okay.
in the law school.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And Ed Briggs in the law school. And Herbert Mason. We had some real top-notch
mm-hmm.
people in their fields. So that impressed me
mm-hmm.
as a young faculty mm-hmm. member. Here were these really top-notch scholars.
How about the student body at the time? Both your relationship, faculty relationship with students, as well as...
Yeah, the student body didn't wake up, really, until environmental movement, Earth Day. Until Earth Day came on the scene. And then there was a very strong component there, because, for one thing, we had professors and programs, like the Environmental Studies program, and Clancy Gordon was he was the one that really catalyzed the environmental movement, the air pollution. He was another one who had a background in plant pathology
mm-hmm.
and so he knew something about disease, and so he studied the effects of air pollutants on plants. Very potent kinds of evidence that he was able to present for the smelter, the aluminum smelter. When he was a student, he did that work in outside of Spokane, in the what was his name again? The Kaiser Aluminum Plant.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he came here, the Garrison Garrison was. Was it a phosphate plant that produced aluminum? Aluminum phosphate, I think, is, yeah. I think whole Deer Lodge Valley, and also the Anaconda smelter.
Mm-hmm.
So he got involved there, and he did a lot of litigation work. So the students really woke up then. And then Vietnam, really, is the thing that catalyzed the students, really got them involved politically.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a hard thing to keep a restraining leash on the students then, because they were really ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
were there original or purely student formed and run political or social organizations, or were they becoming integrated into the service?
There weren't too many students, but they let's say, for example, during the Vietnam War,
mm-hmm.
we had a group that met every Tuesday, the Tuesday noon group, faculty, students, and others.
So they were integrated into the faculty.
And they took leading roles.
Mm-hmm.
They took leading roles in that kind of activity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had the ROTC ceremonies once, they had a march, and they were involved in that. And civil rights, they did a lot with civil rights as well. But that all got sort of mixed up with the Vietnam era.
Mm-hmm.
And then since then, I mean, it's been up and down as far as students are concerned, as far as I can tell. But I think the students are more savvy when it comes to these things now. And more aware, maybe not so active as they were, certainly not so active as they were during the Vietnam
mm-hmm.
era, because that was one of the kinds of public service that some of us thought we should do.
Mm-hmm.
The public service that the faculty was involved in, one of the ways was through this organization called the Scientist Institute for Public Information, SIPI. It was started during the days when atomic weapons were being tested in the atmosphere. And, you know, we were getting radiation all around the world, this radioactive fallout. And Montana was right on the path of the wind currents frequently from coming up from Las Vegas area. So we got involved in that as a committee here. We had a small committee of faculty members, physicians, dentists, radiologists, that affiliated with the national group. Mm-hmm. The national group had been started by Barry Commoner and Margaret Mead. Hmm. And there were about 25 committees like ours around the country. They cut their teeth on the atomic fallout situation, the baby tooth survey. We were getting people to turn in the teeth from the babies that fell out so they could be analyzed for radioactivity.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, they were very effective. So we were part of that movement, and it was a very deep involvement. The Western Montana Scientist Committee for Public Information.
Mm-hmm. When was that?
Well, that must have been started in the late 50s,
mm-hmm.
early 60s. That was a peak of our activity on that issue, because in 1963 there was a limited test ban treaty,
right,
negotiated. And
did that, I mean, were the things that you were doing that test ban?
What we did was to educate ourselves, first of all, specifically. I had some background in biophysics, and others had in anatomy, vertebrate anatomy, like Bert Pfeiffer. Here's a name that is of a historic significance. He came in 59, and he immediately got us going on this radiation
mm-hmm.
thing. We educated ourselves on the biological effects of radiation. That was our main focus. And then we would give talks to groups that invited us, public groups, PTAs, any group that wanted to hear about this. And, you know, everybody was into fallout shelters. And so we'd give the background of, you know, what the radiation could do and so on. And we were supposed to be, we decided that we would be completely objective as much as we could be during our presentations. And then if they asked us, would you build a fallout shelter, we could then express our opinion
mm-hmm.
on that. We thought that was something should be up to the individual.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was an effective way to go.
Was there a fallout shelter on campus in Missoula?
There were.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there were. There's some different public buildings
mm-hmm.
were designated. And but in terms of individual fallout shelters, people still had some questions about that. I guess I better take some water.
So how about some other...
Let me finish
the
story
mm-hmm.
about the radioactive fallout. We were at a meeting. Bert Pfeiffer and I were at a meeting. Well, we were mainly the ones that would do the radiation thing. We had people like Tom Power, who was an early member of our group, and he would do his thing, you know, on economics.
Mm-hmm.
Ron Erickson would on pollution, because he was an organic chemist, so he knew something about what those organic chemicals could do to you, and so on. But we, Bert and I, were the sort of gold dust twins of radiation, and we'd go and give talks, and I would, since I know a little more about the biophysics side, I would discuss radiation from, you know, intrinsic point of view, and then he would come on to say what it could do to people, since
mm-hmm.
he was a zoologist.
Mm-hmm.
And we were at a meeting once back east in Washington, and I guess it was a AAAS meeting, the American Association for Advancement of Science used to have those annual meetings we'd like to go to. And after the session, we went down to the bar to have a a beer, and there was a fellow there sitting near us, and we introduced ourselves, and he asked where we were from and what kinds of things we were doing and brought us there. So we told him about that work, and he said, well, you know, you guys are responsible for the limited test ban treaty, for the Senate ratifying the limited test ban treaty. So that really, you know, really emboldened us.
Right.
Right, so we could continue the work. And then there was a lot of work to do once the missiles came in to Montana. And, you know, Bert was always the firebrand and the shock troop to get us involved. You know, he'd drag us kicking and screaming sometimes into an issue like he did me, to talk about the civil defense hazards associated with missile installations around Great Falls. And so I agreed to do that because there had been a previous study that we could fall back on in Arizona. A fellow named McDonald, a physicist, who analyzed what would happen to Tucson if those Titan missiles were attacked. And so I just applied it to the Montana situation in Great Falls. And I think that was quite effective. It didn't convince the folks in Great Falls, of course.
Right. You could see those missile silos.
To give up. Right. Because it was jobs for them. But I thought that it had an impact wider outside of that. So that's the kind of thing we did in terms of public service. And then Vietnam, same way. Well, especially on the herbicides, as far as Bert Pfeiffer and I were concerned, because I taught about herbicides in my classes, the effects on plants. And then he had been to Vietnam, and where they actually had done the sprays. He had a lot of pictures on the sprays. I concentrated on domestic applications of herbicides, like in the eradication of sagebrush. And I was able to get out and visit with some Forest Service people on some of those projects around the state. So I would talk about that, and he would talk about Vietnam. So that's the type of effort, the type of service, which wasn't always appreciated. I had little difficulty because I wasn't quite so active in the Vietnam story, whereas Bert had a problem with whether that was considered positive or negative service, because there were a lot of people that were upset about criticizing governmental actions. So,
who on campus was critical of those sort of things?
Well, there were, you know, there were people on the faculty who were critical. I think we were overstepping our academic bounds there. I'm not going to, you know, name names, although whether I can remember, I can't really remember. Administrators were critical, and administrators were critical, and he, I believe, he received a negative service evaluation 1 year. But then the campus finally put an end to that because of his work. And because he was, you know, the kind of firebrand he was. You know.
So, you know, you haven't specifically mentioned it, but from your background, from your parents, and you mentioned growing up speaking Yiddish. Am I right to assume that you come from a Jewish background?
Right.
And was there any sort of Jewish community here when you came?
Oh,
did
God,
you search one out? Was that of interest?
I should cite certain references. There's a, Missoula Valley History. The Missoula Valley History, I don't know if you're familiar with that book.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is a piece that I wrote, somewhat immodestly, I have to admit, about the history of the Jewish community up until that time,
mm-hmm.
which was maybe the early 80s. Maybe the early, but that's really in many ways the more interesting part
mm-hmm.
of the history. Because, let's say, through Joe Kramer and Leslie Fiedler, they were part of that community.
Mm-hmm.
There was a very small but very interesting group of folks that would come. It was not an organized community. They'd have services or celebrations of different holidays during the year at their homes. And they're a very interesting group.
And was any of that campus affiliated, or was that just community?
The campus affiliation was tenuous, if at best.
Mm-hmm.
But there were, you know, faculty people involved in that. The campus affiliation happened through a, I think he had campus affiliation, Benjamin Kelson, K-E-L-S-O-N, got a master's degree in history. And the subject of his thesis was the Jews, the history of the Jews of Montana. And it was out of our history department.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember who was his major professor, but I knew that one of the young professors was upset. They didn't think it was scholarly enough, whatever. I'm not going to comment on that, but I think it's a very rather complete picture
mm-hmm.
of the earliest Jews in Montana. And so you'll find that, you would find that history up until the time he wrote. I think it was shortly after I got here. And he wasn't sure. I'm sure he mentioned Leslie Fiedler. Certainly, he must have known Leslie was already making his making waves in literary fields. But he wasn't so sure about me.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd only been here a couple of years. They're a very interesting mix of people, including several who had been immigrants themselves, and were pioneers in the history of Missoula,
mm-hmm.
Montana. And one of the poems in my little booklet of poems, the booklet is called Yippee-Yi Yiddish. That's thanks to Brian Thornton, the bookstore manager, and I thought that was a pretty brilliant stroke. And one of them, well, several of them about some of these early Montana Jews and Missoula.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been involved, you know, that way.
Was there a great overlap of the Jewish community and faculty here with the other sort of service-based things you were doing?
No, mm-hmm. more so nowadays.
Hmm.
Not, you know, not terribly strong now, but certainly very little mm-hmm. at the time.
Because
mm-hmm. some of these old-timers, who the immigrants especially, did have problems. Unfortunately, they're not around to describe them.
Problems on campus or just in the community?
Well, to some extent on campus,
mm-hmm.
but in the community,
mm-hmm.
yeah. Because one of them, Henry Silver, ran this big Broadway general store on West Broadway. It was kind of a landmark in Missoula. And his son took it over, Morris Silver took it over. And that was a big thing in Missoula. And I think he had to really struggle at the time to make his way. Joe Goldman. Joe was, I think, born in this country. I'm pretty sure. He might have come over as a very young lad. But he was born in this, I think he was born in this country. But he was raised in Chicago, but he came here early on in the 30s, I think. and he became a trial lawyer. He took on cases that were no one else would touch. And as a result, he developed a reputation to kind of foster the stereotype. You know, great guy, cigar-smoking lawyer. But he would take on the most difficult cases. And I know from having sat in on some of his clients being there in the office, they were the poorest of the poor. And I think he did a great service for it. But so he received some flack.
Mm-hmm.
I know. He also was the fellow that the people who were passing through, who claimed they were Jewish, although most of them probably were, riding the rails back between Chicago and Seattle, back and forth, and they stopped in Missoula. They always looked Joe Goldman up. I saw that name in the phone book, and they figured he'd be good for a loan. That's called a schnorrer. And I described that in the history.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very interesting aspect of the history.
So talk a little bit, if you will, about just, you know, the arc of both your career here and changes in campus, whether it be faculty, students, growth in campus, change in emphasis. I mean, you've done so up to, you know, sort of the Vietnam era.
Right. When I first came, 49, research was not a big part of the effort. It was teaching, mainly, but there was research, some research going on in the sciences, and I guess quite a bit of creative work. But research, per se, in the sciences was not a strong point until money became available from the federal government. And then, when it was possible to get grants, it burgeoned. And the combination of that money becoming available from the federal government and the money from the state starting a downhill slide made that even more important.
Mm-hmm.
Until when I retired, I felt that the balance had been completely over-skewed.
Towards federal money, towards grant money.
Right, or grant money. Mm-hmm. And to the point where a young instructor, you know, new faculty in the sciences was expected to really, you know, make his way financially. And in a way, I guess I was lucky in the sense that, first of all, I was one of the first that really tapped the federal money after I got here. And secondly, since that wasn't so terribly important, I could just go out in the field and find some interesting phenomenon that was happening. This plant was flowering at an unusual time. Something that I could just follow up out of curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the most fun, of course, when you can do that, especially if you don't require that much equipment to do it. It's feasible.
And what were some of the interesting research projects going on in botany?
Well, or some of them had botany and forestry, we had a professor, Chuck Waters, who was when I came, he was already a well-established researcher. And he was getting his money from the Forest Service to study different fungal diseases of forest trees. And the campground that's named for him down on Bass Creek, C.W. Waters Campground, if you ever go into Bass Creek, that was named for him.
Bass Creek in the Bitterroot.
In the Bitterroot Valley. And it was a disease and that he studied before you actually get to the campground or right in the campground. These big pines are showing certain kinds of witches' brooms. The typical witch's broom of Doug Fir, for example, is not not caused by a fungus, but that one was, and he was a specialist in fungi, especially the rusts, and he did some very valuable work while he was here. Again, you know, it was not the sort of thing they need much more than a teaching lab. A microscope and a petri dish and, you know, shoe leather to go out and collect your samples. And I thought that was certainly one of the kinds of things that just set the pattern. Unfortunately, he died prematurely. I would go out and see a plant in the, well, when we didn't have the all this building between here and the mountain, especially out where we lived in the double X's. Well, we didn't live in the double X's. We lived in a house right next to them on Kent. And I'd walk to school across that field before the X's were put in. And I'd see all kinds of middle annual plants blooming and seeding. And then there was one that was never would seed and flower, never would flower and seed, but it would come back every year. It looked a little bit like an onion, but it didn't smell like an onion or taste like an onion. It was in that family. And then one year I discovered that if you just go up the hill a little ways, there's a plant that has the same kind of leaf and it's in flower. And I thought that was an interesting phenomenon, that just going up slightly in elevation would result in the flowering process, just right at the base of Mount Sentinel. And then just a few feet below, no flowering. I never got anybody, by then I was already deep into my own federal research, federally sponsored research, and I didn't really have time to follow up. But that's the sort of thing that I could follow up, you know. Speaking of Joe Kramer, he never, I don't know whether he published in a peer-reviewed journal, but he would go around and do research on soil temperatures. He always had an ordinary thermometer with him when he'd take his classes out on Waterworks Hill, and he was the one that really, you know, brought Waterworks Hill to everybody's attention about the unique kind of flora that it has on top there. He would take temperatures at different levels of the soil, which he had done his work on soil ecology, which gives you some clues as to what could happen, why things are happening with plants, and so on. That's the kind of thing that was possible here with all the wild lands open to us. So I kind of miss that aspect of the academic enterprise and the of course the collegiality is another thing that they try to overcome with something like this Friday afternoon get together at the Honors College, but most people seem to be interested in drinking beer, but you know, you can meet folks there and talk about what's happening and
You know, it sounds like when you first came that collegiality was a natural thing. People were searching it out. And now you mentioned that, you know, they're trying to promote it.
Right. I think...
When and how did that change? When did it... When did it...
Well, I think... Well, when we started really increasing in numbers, for one thing, that didn't take place until... Well, during the Korean War, I think, I'm not sure that it really coincided, but our numbers were way down. They were talking about eliminating history and political science. I mean, I think history.
Well, history definitely lost its PhD program at some time in there.
Oh, I see. I see.
And there was sort of retrenchment.
Right, there was a general retrenchment. But they even talking about talk about eliminating certain departments. And somehow history stands on our mind, and you know, I think you had some real giants of teachers there, Oscar Hammond and Bob Turner, Mel Wren. And then since then, you know, you've had a whole series of top-notch people in history,
mm-hmm.
you know, the people that I remember. And pharmacy was almost down the tube. They were thinking of eliminating mm-hmm. pharmacy, and look what's happened to it now.
Right.
So
it's big and well-funded.
Right.
So the growth after that, you know, size alone makes a difference in terms of...
I think size makes a mm-hmm. difference.
Mm-hmm.
I think size makes a difference. And the... I think the major influence is the reduction of state support.
Mm-hmm.
Which is especially impacts the non-science people because they could never depend much on federal money, and in some ways they don't need that much in the way of support for what they do, for what they publish, you know, or even math, a field like math. But I think the reduction in state support has had a very negative effect on,
mm-hmm.
on the freedom to explore at the university. We had some episodes of, you know, criticism from state legislators when we were being active during pre-Vietnam, too. We had our own little McCarthy type things going on in the state ledger where we had to sign a loyalty oath. And I don't know how we got rid of that, but that was one kind of thing that was happening.
Has there been a diminishment in the emphasis on service amongst faculty along with the growth and decrease in general collegiality?
You know, I don't know for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I think it probably was not only that, but I got the impression that teaching was, you know, not considered that important, especially in the sciences. But since I've been retired, since 1990,
mm-hmm.
I really, you know, don't have a good feel as to what's happening
mm-hmm.
On the relative importance
mm-hmm.
to the individual faculty member of the various things he's supposed to do, he or she is supposed to do.
You know, you mentioned in... Joe Kramer going around and taking his soil samples and, mm-hmm. and you as well, you know, observing plants and that
right.
being part of your extracurricular research.
A big part because mm-hmm. I felt that even though much of it was not publishable, it was very important. It could contribute greatly to the teaching effectiveness
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
because it, you know, provided examples, real live examples
mm-hmm.
of your subject mm-hmm. matter.
You may or may not, you know, along those lines, you may or may not be able to comment on, but, you know, in the early 80s, and of course, a big thing going on in Missoula right now is the removal of the Milltown Dam.
Uh-huh.
And it was a university professor, I believe, who went out and first did some samples in the reservoir as well as with the water samples, groundwater samples
mm-hmm.
in people's homes that sort of kicked off the public consciousness of
yeah.
the problems of that.
Yeah, I don't have a very strong recollection of who that might be, but Clancy Gordon would be a good possibility of that. But, you know, even some of the people who were, Hal Brown, a physician, got involved in air pollution, and I don't know whether he was involved in the water pollution aspect of that too. I'm trying to think of who some of those people be. Some of the geologists I know would have a great interest. Clancy Gordon could very well have been the one, since he was doing that professionally in the sense that he was teaching classes on air pollution, mm-hmm. Water pollution in general. But then Vicki Watson, I don't know how long she's been here, because time is just flying by, but she took Clancy's place. And she became, her particular interest was water mm-hmm. pollution. And so I know she has, she did a lot. She must have done a lot shortly after she came here. And then I know some of the geologists' development interest later on, Johnny Moore and Bill Wussner, who's here now recently, Garen Smith, of course, is he teaches about pollution, but mostly he's affiliated. His work is done in connection with the pulp mill.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that tests my memory.
So you retired in 1990.
I did retire in 1990, 2 years into my 3 year,
mm-hmm.
2 years into my 3 year post-retirement contract, because after the second year of teaching on that, somehow or other, I didn't seem to be on the same wavelength with the students in my plant physiology class. I just wasn't getting that same kind of feedback
mm-hmm.
that I was accustomed to, and so I didn't want to put myself through that or through the end of the semester evaluations,
mm-hmm.
which could be quite painful
mm-hmm.
to read. So I retired full time
mm-hmm.
after 2 years, but unfortunately, when my colleague Mark Behan, who is now retired, asked me to take over his class next year for a week, since he had to be away, I had a delightful experience with the students.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, maybe I was premature. I really wasn't ready to retire in that sense. And, you know, I have felt that I miss student contact in general.
Mm-hmm.
But
I was
pressured
mm-hmm.
to leave because of make more money available,
mm-hmm.
not that much more, but
mm-hmm.
for a new faculty, which they didn't hire.
You know, it's not often you see, or I've talked to someone who has spent their entire academic career teaching at one university. What is
right.
it that, or is there a single or a number of things that have kept you in one place here at the University of Montana?
Yes. Well, I'd have to say I did occasionally apply for other positions. There was at least one case when I was well into my career here that I had a chance to go to the University of Massachusetts in their, when they were establishing a new Boston campus. But I just had mixed feelings about it. I was getting a little restless in terms of people in my field, because generally we tend to have one person represent any particular discipline in the broad field like botany, and I thought it'd be nice to have some more people that I could talk to. And so I decided against it. And once or twice before I had looked into some other job, but we had gotten so, we had fallen so in love with Missoula. And in general, the kind of campus experience would permit you to really throw yourself in to life in general, as you know, academically as well as socially, politically, and otherwise. And of course, I just fell in love with the environment here, hiking and skiing. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't see giving that up mm-hmm. on a permanent basis.
And of course, so, it's kept you here since you've retired.
Pretty much. And then I was able to get grants for sabbaticals, and I had a few Fulbright experiences, National Academy of Science exchanges, and so, you know, it kept me getting out, and I could get some money to go to international meetings, and so I was happy to mm-hmm. do that. I suppose in a way I looked at my rather, I don't know how you would describe how people looked at me. Montana, you know, it's like something in another planet. Except for the very rare person had been here, you know. Then it was Montana? They, you know, really have science going on there? Also, you mean there are other Jews in Montana? I kind of, you know, in a way I resented it, but then I felt like a celebrity.
Right.
So this kind of eclectic life you could lead mm-hmm. here, and with my wife, I couldn't blast her out of here anyway. So, and our kids all grew up and went to school here, mm-hmm. of course, since we stayed. But and then I still find it a good place to be.
Mm-hmm. You know? So with as, I suppose, little modesty as you can muster, what will you be remembered for, do you suspect, in terms of your time on faculty at the University of Montana?
Well, you'd have to really talk to my colleagues about that, but I, you know, I'd like to think that I would be remembered as a dedicated teacher, and a good human being, and someone interested in people, and in bringing about a better world.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, this is going to be on tape, isn't it?
This is going to be on tape.
Okay, I'll have to save that for the obituary.
Well, it's been fascinating talking to you. I would like to offer you the opportunity to add anything else that you'd like to.
If I think of anything, David, I certainly will.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, David.